Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday. I'm still on that Tuesday time schedule. Yes, it's Wednesday. It's the 2nd of June, and we are very happy to have you with us on this fine day. A beautiful day outside, at least so far, and we look forward to talking to you about a whole range of issues. We've got a lot of cool things to talk about, and by cool, I mean interesting and different, but some of them are, yes, horribly depressing. 14 minutes past the hour, we welcome your calls by, what do we call them? Letters. That's it. Thank you.
Letters.
Thank you. Email. That's what we call them. Yeah. I'm back a week where we were still soliciting phone calls.
Your letters may not get here in time for
that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
If you have a complaint, though, feel free to send a letter.
That's right. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me get to introduce everybody. It's a great thrill. I know I probably sound like a broken record, but it's just so nice to have everybody in the studio and to see everybody. And it's a real, we're still not over that of seeing all our friends come back to the studio.
Well, almost everybody in the studio.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know if we were. I didn't know how truthful we were going to be on that.
We've got everybody we need, don't we?
Well, that's right. You do. I'm here playing halfback, so I know about that.
Yeah. Well, you're. So, yeah, we are Alan. Alan and I are here in the are in our respective radio studios. How's that for
that's much better.
Yes, there you go. And in this room we have wonderful people who two of which I have not seen in a very long time, so it's a great thrill to welcome them. But first, Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. As I say, halfback, but I did my walk. Went okay.
Okay.
And like that, and here I am waiting to see what happens today. You never know.
You never know. We will get to that and find out what happens, because we will make it happen in mere moments.
Yes.
We also are thrilled to have back to our studio and back on our program. It's been a little tiny while. Dean of College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I am so thrilled to be here. What a beautiful morning. Just one quick comment for everybody who graduated last week from the University at Albany or the other area colleges and universities. Congratulations, and congratulations to the parents. It's a wonderful achievement. So any graduate out there, well done.
And you made it. You made it through one of the weirdest senior years you will ever, the perhaps any generation could ever face. But there you go.
That's the hope.
You did it. Yes, yes. Exactly. I know in our current culture, we're probably not allowed to say this, but you look great.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I know you had a good weight loss program over the last time we've seen you, and you look great.
Thank you so much.
Good for you.
It's been very good for me.
Yes. Well, you look very, very good. Speaking of looking very, very good, am I allowed to say that, Rosemary?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Or hubba hubba or any of those.
Okay. I don't know. I don't want to get anybody mad. No, investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Chris Churchill, Times Union columnist and our good friend. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to be not sitting in my car, which is the way I've done this for the last 18 months or whatever it was.
I was vaguely aware of that, and yet you just made that sound really sad. So I'm glad
all
you're
by
here.
Myself on cold winter mornings, running the heater whenever, you know, during the little breaks. Yeah.
It's nice. We're all back. We're all vaccinated. I keep making that point. People say, "I can't believe you're all back." We're all vaccinated. Mm-hmm. You have to. the panelists have to sign their life away to get into the studio. So here they are, and we're thrilled that they are with us this morning. All right, let's get to the subjects at hand. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we will talk about voting protections at the Tulsa event yesterday. Of course, yesterday, the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre, which took place on May 31st and June 1st, 1921. Biden announced that his vice president, Kamala Harris, will lead a push for voting protections in response to states' recent ballot restrictions. He promised to, quote, these are fighting words, fight like heck.
Inspiring.
Let the record show. Rosemary just rolled her eyes. Should have said hell. Against Republican efforts to restrict voting, using the anniversary of a racist massacre in Tulsa to respond to Democrats' growing anxiety that his low-key approach was threatening fair elections and their own electoral future. Biden announced that he was tapping Vice President Harris to marshal an effort against the increasing array of Republican-led state laws that restrict voting in various ways, a campaign Biden condemned as un-American. He said, quote, this sacred right is under assault with incredible intensity like I've never seen, adding that June should be a month of action on Capitol Hill and taking what appeared to be a shot at Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, suggesting that they often side with Republicans. So I will begin with you, Alan, and ask what you make of this. And also, just how much can the president do on this and in putting Vice President Harris on the case of what actually are the possibilities?
Well, Joe, he's doing exactly the right thing. You know, he's taking the gloves off. He's saying, enough, Mr. Nice Guy. We have a potential dictator here. I've been saying this for quite a while, and he's saying it now. He's talking about the potential death of democracy. And he's right, because this terrible ex-president of ours is all about doing what has been done in so many countries, taking over. And now talking about, you know, having his people say, you know, this is we gotta make a change here, and we gotta take over from Biden, and the real president is still out there. Well, this is terrifying. It is terrifying because it's been successful in other countries, and you know, I think it's about time that Biden did take off the gloves and make it clear that the death of democracy is what could come out of Trumpism.
Donald Trump said on Tuesday that he expects to be back in office by August. Bob
Can
Griffin.
Can you imagine?
Bob.
Yeah, that August comment kind of blew me away, too. Although anytime Trump says something like that, usually there's some sort of court or legal issue that's coming down the pike that he's trying to get us not to look at. You know, Alan, I think you're spot on. And I think what the president also is doing is he's trying to do what presidents should do, and that's be the moral weather vane for the country. I wish he was a little bit stronger on it. I wish he would be more vocal about how bedrock voting rights are and easy access to voting is. I mean, it's fundamental to our country. And as I've thought about what's happening in the states, particularly looking at what's happening in places like Texas and Florida and Georgia, you know, you start to see the seeds of an apartheid system here, where a very small minority is manipulating the rules and the laws in order to stay in power over a majority. And I do think this is a very dangerous time for this country and democracy. And I'm disgusted with the lack of voices from GOP about state rights and about the protection of voting and in the state of our democracy.
It is.
It's the installation of fascism. That's what it is. I mean, no less than that.
Rosemary.
Well, first of all, I have some concerns that he's turning Kamala Harris into Jared Kushner. She's already got immigration in the southern border, and now he's throwing this on her. She's great. I totally support her, but she's completely inexperienced in both these areas, and they're the two thorniest problems of the past two administrations. So I think that's completely unrealistic. If you mean by taking off the gloves that he's put another job in her assignment list and said heck in public, I don't see it. If I were he, I'd be talking a whole lot with Joe Manchin, who's the key to this. This we need federal regulations. We need a federal law to undo what's happening in the state level, and that is very scary. And there are two ways to do it. One is to get rid of the filibuster, and Manchin is the key to that. And two is to barter with Manchin, who has actually a really good idea on voter rights, which is that we go back to the old rule, but instead of making 10 states, the southern states, the old Confederacy, liable to prove that you're being fair, you make all 50 states be fair. That would work. It would be really hard again for the Republicans to say they're against that, and there's a real possibility of making it work. That's what I'd be doing, not saying fighting words and saying, oh, yeah, Kamala is going to save us all. I don't believe it.
So, Rosemary, don't you think that he had to check with her before he gave her that assignment and that it's possible she even asked for it?
Don't you think Trump checked with Jared before he said, can you cure cancer and also fix the Middle East? And he wanted the assignment?
No.
Yeah. Rosemary, let me just.
No, I really don't.
I don't either. No, look, I think they've got a working relationship, obviously. And I think she's a partner. And he is throwing her the big stuff. But I can't believe that she didn't want it.
I think that's immaterial. I don't think she can do it, is my point. I don't think she has the clout, experience, or heft to do it.
She was a United States Senator. You know, she's been there. She knows what has to be done. She wanted the job, and I think she wanted to be president, as a matter of fact. And I think it's a great vote of confidence in this woman vice president. No kid gloves here.
But also, she's our first African-American vice president. She's our first African-American president or vice president. And, vice president, I should say, and female. And she's taking on this huge issue of voting rights, which so impacts black and brown people. So that makes sense in and of itself, does it not?
May I remind you, we had a black president who couldn't solve the problem of race in America. You're putting way too much weight on this woman, who, again, let me repeat, I have nothing but respect for. I think she will add immensely to the battle, but to put it all on her back is just asking for failure. But if you're going to put it on one black woman's back, why not Stacey Abrams?
Well,
Stacey Abrams is not the vice president. Yeah. right.
And I hope she keeps on writing mystery novels, because I just finished hers and it's really good.
Stacey Abrams?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Chris Churchill, go ahead.
Well, I'm probably going to take a little bit of an unpopular position here and just to suggest that I think a lot of the language that is being used about elections is overwrought from kind of both political parties. I mean, already this morning we've heard words like fascism, apartheid, death of democracy. And I think if you actually look closely at the laws that are under consideration in some of these states, they're not nearly as dramatic as people are suggesting they are. And, you know, in some cases, New York's voting laws are more restrictive than the laws that these states are seeking to put into place. I somewhat understand the overwrought reaction given the claims about a stolen election and the fact that a lot of these laws are attempting to respond to a GOP base that is convinced that the election was stolen. Yeah. But for the most part, the impact on actual voting, I don't think, is going to be significant. I mean, depending, different states have different laws. I don't want to paint with a broad brush. But I do think that the rhetoric on both sides about elections has gotten dangerous. I don't think these laws are going to put apartheid or fascism or are going to kill democracy.
Don't you think, though, Chris, that these laws are purposely designed to make it more difficult for people, particularly people of color, to vote? That this is being put in place specifically in response to the loss of the election and the big lie?
I do think so, and I think that's why I do understand the reaction. But I think if you actually look at the language of the bills, I mean, you know, the Georgia law would have left in place more early voting than New York has, right? I think we need to look at our own laws as well. Just because the state is a blue state doesn't mean that it's – New York has long had some of the most restrictive voting laws in the country. Yeah. There are elements of the Texas law that are certainly objectionable, the Sunday morning voting part of it in particular, which I think –
Why don't you explain that? Because I'm really offended by that one.
There's been some debate about whether this is actually in the final bill or not. But apparently, in some versions of the bill, it would restrict early voting on Sunday mornings, which would seems like a pretty direct attempt to kill the souls to the polls. Is that what they call it?
Right.
You know, you go to
church,
vote after,
you pray, and then you go vote.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Which in a deeply religious state like Texas is kind of ironic. But, you know, a lot of the other measures are not really that dramatic. You know, a lot of them just kind of put into place relatively common sense things. And then some instances, they actually expand early voting a little bit. So I think there's more nuance to this than people are voicing.
We have about 30 seconds. So go ahead.
Okay, the question I wanted to ask, Chris, is do you think Trump is a potential fascist?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's hard to argue against that after what we saw on January 6th. I mean, I think he literally would have stolen the election if he'd been given the chance. You know, in one respect, though, you know, there's a kind of a push to federalize elections. And I think in some senses that might be a mistake because, you know, if Trump had the election power under his fingers, I think, you know, we would have been closer to a stolen election than we actually got with all the states doing it on their own.
All right, we're going to take a break and we'll pause there. We do have we have a lot of letters on this, so we'll get to those when we come back. I promise we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue with our conversation this morning after news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Robert Griffin. We call him Bob. I think you can too.
Please.
Panel@WAMC.org. And so we have letters on what we've been talking about. We'll continue the conversation. Bob, I will say that during the break you said there's one thing I do want to bring up. What was that?
Yeah, the comment that you made about Trump talking about coming back in August concerns me because of a couple issues. One is that it keeps his base fired up with this idea that the big lie is the truth. But over the weekend, General Flynn, who was the disgraced national security advisor, came out and basically endorsed a military coup. And you start to put these pieces together, and I do worry about what folks who are listening to Trump are thinking about. So it's just there's a couple of points that are out right now that are worrying me about potential violence and obviously the strength of our democracy.
We got a letter from a listener taking me to task for saying that Trump said that when he did not say it. It was conjecture. But in looking it up, Maggie Haberman is reporting that he has been telling people and has said, quote, that he expects that he will get reinstated by August.
I have at least one relative who is convinced that in 6 weeks, it may be 5 weeks now, that
rapture.
The date is very important. That the Supreme Court is going to vote 9-0 to overturn the election and reinstall Trump.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. Smart person too. I mean, a professional. The lack of civics knowledge is, I think, a problem in this country because I don't know what the mechanism is for how this gets to the Supreme Court so quickly. And, you know.
There's a relative of yours, Chris?
Yeah. I won't name the person.
It was great how you answered that. Is this a relative of yours, Chris?
Yeah. Mother-in-law?
No, yeah. But it's disturbing. And I have spent, you know, many, many frustrating hours trying to convince this person that it's all a bunch of hooey, and I haven't succeeded, let's put it that way.
It's ingrained.
The reason I brought that up is, though, this is, you know, to go back to what Bob said, or Robert. This is out there. This is floating around out there. This isn't, it isn't just
he
Trump.
Lost so much weight, he lost his former name.
Yes.
He's now Bob.
Yeah, he's a skinnier
name. Wanted to know
name.
Something, yeah. Rosemary?
Yeah, I wanted to know why you leapt to the possible conclusion that it had to be Chris's mother-in-law.
You know, you're absolutely right. I do apologize abjectly. And number one, and And number two, I want to say it was probably his father-in-law.
it was neither, although they may believe similar things. Yeah, my wife is going to kill me for this.
Yeah. Can we have a...
You're used to going back on that program.
We have a ton of letters, and I love looking just at the subject lines because it's like, really, Chris? And thanks, Chris. Rosemary, seriously? And just things like that. You haven't been named yet, Bob.
You're not controversial
enough,
Bob. We'll
get to it.
Because they're confused about his name.
That's right. All right. So we get this. Voting law changes from Nancy. I completely disagree with Chris that some of the voting law changes are less restrictive than the existing laws in place like New York and Connecticut. What worries me about the laws, though, is that most of them contain a provision that allows local election results to be overturned by either the legislature or a state official. That provision is what we should worry about. Well,
and not only that, taking some of the power away from the state officials who were ruling about the continuity of elections and everything else, and those people are being thrown out of the loop. So it's not only the new ones who are coming in, it's the ones who are doing the right thing who are being thrown out.
Well, I mean, that may be true in some cases, but I will point out that the Georgia Secretary of State, whose name is escaping me right now, who was quite heroic during last November, was defending the Georgia law. So, you know, if he feels that it's undermining him, he didn't say so publicly.
Well, you never know, do you, Chris? I mean, you never know whether somebody says, okay, I've taken these anti-Trump stances. He was a hero, no question about it, and I'm getting creamed, as we used to say, riding the waves. I'm sorry, Rosemary, on Fire Island. So it may well be, you never know, that he decided enough courage for a while.
We got this letter from John, who said, thank you, Chris Churchill. I deeply appreciate that Chris has the intellectual honesty to point out how states like New York limit access to voting and political inclusion. Please, let's start telling the truth about bipartisan attempts to limit participation and real, quote-unquote, democracy. Followed that up by, really, Chris?
Wait. That's a very interesting issue, because I've long said that when the Democrats who are in the legislature, they got there under the old rules, not new rules, not reformist rules. So there's no question that what the writer is suggesting may be true, because it's been a loaded system for a long time, and it took Democrats and Republicans to make it that way.
Yeah, the people who are in power pass laws that entrench their power. I mean, that's
absolutely.
Both parties do it, and it's obviously unfortunate.
Absolutely right.
There's another point, though, back to an earlier letter. The other part of the law that really worries me is that the standard that can overturn an election is a preponderance of evidence, which means that basically if somebody feels like it was that something was wrong, which I think most people who lose an election feel like there was something is wrong, could use that as a standard to overturn the election. So there's a lot of bad language in some of these bills. With that said, I do agree with both the letter writer and you, Chris, that, you know, New York needs to look at itself. This is a hard place to really vote, and we should be leading the country in making it easier for people to vote.
Mm-hmm. Another Bob writes and says, some southern states may have expanded early voting by a few days, but the minor improvement is dwarfed by the new restrictions, such as banning 24-hour voting, which was used heavily by 9-to-5 workers, and requiring drop boxes to be in government buildings and manned whenever they are open. And let's not forget limiting polling places in minority areas and disallowing outside groups to financially support nonpartisan voting. It's a witch's brew of voter suppression.
There are two things, though, about how lopsided these laws tend to be. I think that writer is right, that, yes, New York has some terribly restrictive laws, but it restricts everything. The new laws we're seeing are aimed directly at minority voters, and that means before they're going to be reinforced or before they're installed, made practicable, there are going to be challenges. This is going to wind up in courts, in the whole federal system, and end up in the Supreme Court. So I think that we're actually years away from actually seeing them be try to be enforced. And secondly, it's going to annoy and anger and restart, rekindle the civil rights movement. We're back to the 1960s with this.
Well, to that,
and,
to that,
there'll be a reaction.
To that point, didn't we see that in reaction
Georgia.
To the, well, in Georgia, but across the country in reaction to the United States Postal Service and the actions that were being taken of the boxes being removed and showing the mail sorters out in the parking lot and that kind of thing, where people said, okay, well, no, we're still going to vote. We're going to get out. That it does work to the other side.
The problem is that none of that is permanent. None of the actions that have been taken on voting or other things too, like leases in the Arctic, are permanent. And just as Biden came in and undid everything Trump did, the next guy, if it's not, God forbid it's Trump, but if it's a Republican, we'll undo it and we'll be right back where we were. What this country requires...
The next woman that comes in.
Next woman, that'd be even better. But what this country requires, what it's built on through the Constitution, is that laws are permanent and they're made by Congress. And Congress has abdicated that.
Yeah, there's another element here too, Joe, that I'd like to toss into the pile. And it's not just race, it's also class.
Yeah.
If you start to think about people who are, you know, you're working a job that you can't take time off, you don't have all day to stand in line to
right.
vote, you have to work, you don't get off until after the polls close. I mean, that class plays a role in this as well, and I think we need to be very careful about the seeds of class distrust that a lot of these bills also raise.
But, you know, to Chris's point too, and I live in a rural area, but, you know, here in New York, you have early voting. But I got to go to the county center to do it, and that's 35 miles away. So how many people are going to be able to do that when they can, or even to have the gas money to get up there and back? So there's a lot of problems there. We have many more letters. I'll get to a couple here before we go to a break. Real quick, Biden has given Harris some jobs well known to be intractable. This is trial by fire, not to make her fail, but to let the American people see how well she deals with failure. Teresa says the blatant attacks on voting rights by the GOP are sickening. Thanks, Robert. What tangible actions do you think those of us in New York can do to fight against this? By the way, I totally agree with Rosemary regarding Vice President Harris.
I mean, there's a couple things. Letters, emails to our congressional delegation, to all of our congressional delegation, certainly helps. I think at the local level, where change really begins, that we should be working as communities to make it easier for people to vote. And again, as I said a little bit earlier, that New York should become the model for modern voting, not the system that we have right now. And it begins at the local level.
And, you know, when I'm asked about, Bob, about how people can make a difference, I always talk about letters to the paper, for example, letters to the newspaper, which can be extraordinarily impressive to a legislator who is trying to hold on to their seat. His or her, and so they see this letter, and I've seen them cut them out in my day hanging around the legislature and say, get me one of these.
Yeah, Alan, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and in response to the question from the letter writer, you have to stay squeaky. You know, a lot of times what politicians are waiting for is the news cycle to pass and something else to take over, and our memories aren't what they should be. But you have to continue to keep the heat on.
And, you know, I keep wondering what I would do in this particular situation. You know, we've had some hints from some of the Trumpers that they intend to take over. They intend to... to insert themselves and make it clear that they are, you know, that they're going to be president again before the next election. So my question to myself is, what would I do? You know, would I fight? And how would I fight? And with what weapons would I fight? I don't know if that's occurred to anybody else, but here these people are saying, we're going to take it over and not be voted in, but we're going to do it anyway. Well, what would you do?
I'll never support violence. I think violence begets violence, and I think we have to have some confidence in ourselves, our communities, and our laws. But Alan, you're right. I mean, it's a particularly scary time. You don't have to be violent to exercise your freedom of speech. You don't have to be violent to join others in your community, and peacefully and legally march and gather. And we probably do need that type of activity. And one thing I'll give up to the Trump folks is that they get their people out and they get them enthused, and the rest of us cannot just sit back and watch them and think they're just kooks.
So what do you do? I mean, is there a point that you fight? You literally fight. You grab a kitchen knife. You do whatever you have to do. If in fact they have taken over the government, and they're saying that he's going to be named president even though he's not been elected, what would you do?
All right, I'm going to leave that hanging in the air because we have to take a break and we're late. And I'm getting a cold stare from Mike Bowen. So let's take a break. We'll be back.
He's a big guy.
We'll take over that. And weirdly, he's looking for a kitchen knife. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It is the 2nd of June, and we welcome you. Still a lot of letters, so I'll go back to those to bring us up to the top of the hour. We got this from Michael. This is for you, Rosemary. What a dumb remark, Rosemary. Kushner was a pawn of Trump, an evil extension of his plan, not anywhere near Kamala, a decent, honorable public servant.
She still has too much work to do.
Harris is not Kushner, says Marissa. Big difference is that Harris was actually elected. I disagree that she doesn't have the experience and clout comes with the office, both as a senator and now VP. Kushner was an arrogant, unelected neophyte. That is Marissa's view.
I agree about Kushner, but same comment as last time.
Okay. We go to now Denise. How about running for school boards? In response to what can people do? Denise says, how about running for school boards and planning commissions, et cetera? The right wing is taking over such local offices on a wholesale level in many states. And again, Democrats are mostly just shaking their collective head.
Yeah, Joe, that's an excellent point. And if you look what's happening on local school boards, also if you look what's happening on boards like library commissions and library trustees, it's controlling the knowledge. It's controlling the message. And it is very dangerous. I mean, this whole idea of rewriting American history so it sort of fits in this sanitized Disney-esque approach, which is happening in places like Texas right now, is particularly scary because if you don't know your history, you are bound to repeat it again. But you have to start local, and you got to think about those little boards and commissions. You're absolutely correct because they impact your lives in ways you don't even realize until it's too late. You put a couple of wackos on a library board, all of a sudden they're getting rid of Harry Potter books and things like that.
Yeah. Now, can I give a shout out here to our own Libby Post, who back in 2016, when some of us, I'm pointing at myself, were losing our minds with despair. She just dug in and put together a local action group, and they raised candidates and sought out actually great progressive and liberal and open, anti-Trump candidates. And slowly and surely, they've had success. They continue to work. And I was so impatient at the time. There's no way that I wanted to get involved with that at all. I wanted some big, grand, and sweeping gesture. And that has proved to be correct. Libby is one of the heroes, along with Stacey Abrams, who just dug back in and went back to work. And that's really it's going to take.
Yeah. It used to be a saying that all politics was local, but all politics have really gotten federalized in recent years.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who pay close attention to what's happening in Washington and no attention whatsoever to what's happening in Albany or much less their local village what's board.
Well, I was going to say that.
Sure you were.
No.
No, honest, he was.
No, what I was going to say is, local stuff is great. School boards are great. But there's no reason you can't run for Congress. There's no reason. I know they raise a lot of money.
Liz Light can run. Anybody
wait,
can.
Wait, I'm not done
sorry.
Yet.
I'm
wait,
sorry.
Wait.
I just wanted to emphasize, you're right. If Liz Light can run for Congress, anyone can, Alan.
Not only that, but take a look at AOC. That guy who she beat was unbeatable. He was right. going to be the speaker. And she decided to do it. Sometimes you just have to have a little courage and do it. And if you lose, you lose. On the other hand, not enough people are running for the state legislature mm-hmm. because it's almost an endowed position. You get it, and you're there for life, and that's crazy. And I think there's no reason somebody can't declare and run for the Senate or the Assembly.
Let's go to letters here. I'll get to as many as I can before we go to over to news with Ray. Judy says, I'm hoping Trump will be in prison in 2024. What do you think his chances are of being indicted and convicted?
I'm not betting the house on it.
All right. Anyone else on that?
It's hard
I'm hoping
to know.
For it.
Yeah. Joan says, thank you for discussing the fear regarding Flynn's comments and Trump's as well. When you put the different items together, it's frightening. I worry my son with my fear and try to stay even. Being 65, I worry as this nation is not the nation I grew up in. While we have never been perfect, today's situation is truly frightening.
That's right.
Fred says, Chris Churchill makes a great point about how restrictive New York State's voting laws are. Last year, Cuomo and the Democratic Party establishment raised the threshold for third parties to qualify to be on the ballot, which resulted in such vital parties as the Greens and Libertarians being removed from the ballot. Changes made.
It wasn't that. It was the working. I'm sorry for interrupting. It was the Working Families Party that he was after. He was furious with the Working Families people because they had supported an opponent against him. And that was what that was all about.
Just finishing up the letter, changes made because of pandemic show that mail-in voting should be made permanent in New York State, and the greatest reform all states should make is ranked choice voting, which would give voters a wide range of options while eliminating the spoiler effect of voting for third parties.
We're going to have to see. We're going to have to see whether Andrew Yang gets clobbered because of third-party voting.
In New York City, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go to, let's see here. We go to Keith. Come on, Chris. These new anti-democratic bills allow for secretaries of state to overturn elections on a whim. There is no real election fraud in the 21st century in U.S. presidential elections unless you want to consider Trump asking Russia to interfere in our elections. These bills are specifically designed to suppress minority votes and steal elections.
I like that. I like that letter.
There is election fraud. I mean, wasn't there a North Carolina congressional race that was redone because the fraud was significant? You know, we've had.
But Chris,
it was Republicans.
It was Republicans.
I know
but
that.
That's
yeah.
not the point.
No, I'm
it
just
was
saying.
Captured, and the guy was punished, and the election was
right.
taken care of.
Well, the letter writer said there's no such thing as election fraud. Well, I think that was a case. You know, there have been numerous cases in Troy of election fraud and election. You know, I'm not saying
it's not a problem.
No, I'm not going to say that. It doesn't exist. I'm also not going to say that elections are being stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Janice says, remember the Women's March after the 2016 election? Should we have pulled a coup then? It was a rigged election. We missed our opportunity to hold him responsible, and to this day he is getting away with it all. Yeah. Peaceful demonstration produces nothing. Just ask any Republican.
Well, you know something? I need people to go back. It stopped the war. There was a time in this country when you could take to the streets and you could show your support for a position and you could make change. And I don't think that time is over. I just think that as a society, we've gotten lazy and we don't want to give up our free time to deal with things like community issues and running for volunteer boards and coming out on a weekend and dealing with political issues. So I do think there's still a huge role for nonviolence, and I think there's a huge role for letting for the people's voice to be heard.
Bridget says, look no further than Rensselaer County for voter suppression. Thanks to Attorney General James for calling them out. What Joe said, I just finished Reckless by Stacey Abrams. Murder mystery, thriller romance, steamy and fun.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, that's cool. Debbie says, hello. Hello. I think this is how it's supposed to be read. Hello. Texas hello. And Georgia. All right. Sounds like Book of Mormon there. Hello. Texas and Georgia are putting in provisions where they can overturn the outcome. What could be more undemocratic than that? Lynn says these voting restrictions affect the elderly of all colors, and I would trust Stacey Abrams to get voting rights and a bill done. Bob says, is there any mechanism by which Biden could call both houses of Congress together and force them to read the Constitution out loud with their right hand in the air and their left hand on a Bible? I know they have all done it before, but it didn't seem to take the first time. And our final letter before we go over to a break, and this is from Eric. Rather than taking off the gloves, Biden may have to offer the carrot rather than use the stick. Perhaps he will offer to set up a naval base in West Virginia. Problem is that he will then have to establish one in Arizona as well. That's the way it is done.
He keeps offering them a carrot and they don't take it. Come on. We know what this is about.
Bobby Byrd did get the Coast Guard to build a huge facility in West Virginia. And last time I checked, there's no coast in West Virginia.
Good.
Someday. With global warming, you may be right.
Could happen. All right, we'll take a break. We'll pause there, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll move on to other issues as well. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin, all here. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It's the 2nd of June, and we are thrilled to have you with us. We have a great panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We've been talking about voting protections for the last hour and got into a good-spirited discussion. We have many other things to discuss, so we'll move on. And we, again, welcome your letters. Interesting article in the New York Times yesterday, which I think is something that we have all dealt with, but perhaps we're not talking about a whole lot, which I find interesting, which is the headline to the article is How the World Ran Out of Everything. Yeah. Global shortages of many goods reflect the disruption of the pandemic combined with decades of companies limiting their inventories. And, you know, we're, what, 14, 15 months into the pandemic, and you still can walk into the grocery store and say, why is there no pasta whatsoever on the store shelves? Or why can't you get tuna fish? That seems odd.
That's why I hoarded it, Bob. I have tuna fish.
Well, Bob was Mr. Hoarder, right?
Bob's responsible for a lot of the shortages.
Not the pasta. I have not had pasta in a year and a half. Maybe that's why it's off the shelf, because I ate so much beforehand.
So over the last half century, in this story of how the modern world was constructed, Toyota stands out as the mastermind of a monumental advance in industrial efficiency. The Japanese automaker pioneered so-called just-in-time manufacturing, in which parts are delivered to factories right as they're required, minimizing the need to stockpile them. Over the last half century, this approach has captivated global business and industries far beyond automobiles, from fashion to food processing to pharmaceuticals. Companies have embraced just-in-time to stay nimble, allowing them to adapt to changing market demands while cutting costs. But the tumultuous events of the past year have challenged the merits of pairing inventories, while reinvigorating concerns that some industries have gone too far, leaving them vulnerable to disruption. As the pandemic has hampered factory operations and sown chaos in global shipping, many economies around the world have been bedeviled by shortages of a vast range of goods, from electronics to lumber to clothing. You want to have a 45-minute conversation? Walk into any hardware store in this country and ask about lumber, and you are going to get quite a conversation about the price of it, the lack of it, and how they wanted to build a deck this year, but now they can't. Mm-hmm. So it is in a time of extraordinary upheaval in the global economy, just in time is running late. It's sort of like a supply chain run amok, says Willie Tsai, who is an international trade expert at the Harvard Business School. In a race to get to the lowest costs, I've concentrated my risk. We are at the logical conclusion of all of that. So it is an interesting story because whether you are looking for shoes or you are looking for meat, I mean, well, meat is a whole other issue given the cyber attack, mm-hmm. which we can talk about briefly too. But also, just things that we expect that are so hard, cars. So, I mean, drive into a lot and look at the new cars. Mm-hmm. There aren't many, if any, which is interesting as well. And so, what does that do? And I guess the two questions are. Yes, how did the world run out of everything and this just-in-time approach that seems to have failed with a pandemic? But also, now what do we do about it and how do we kind of bring back a faltering economy when you also want to buy things but can't? Alan.
Well, you know, first of all, I don't know. And second of all, I think what's going to happen is that now with the pandemic over, people are going to see opportunities, as they always do in America. And what has made America so great over the years compared to some of the communist countries and other places is the ability to get goods out there, to advertise, to let people know what's available. I think we can pretty well rely on the fact that that's going to happen again, that as people see opportunities and economic opportunities, they're going to grab them and that it'll be fine. Now, whether or not that exists in every country, I don't know.
Chris?
So what I took away from this story is that when the clerk tells you they don't have your size on the back, she's probably telling the truth. Because, you know, these stores just don't have the inventory they used to have.
It's not that they're being lazy and just don't want to look in the back. They really don't have it.
Yeah.
Everything they have is indeed out.
Yeah.
It's
but you know, this depends on fast shipping too. You know, I mean that's part of the
story
too. Without the trucks and the ships and everything delivering.
But with the reaction, I'm sorry, but with the realization that not only, Bob, as you mentioned, I mean, it affects our buying of cars, it affects the building of houses, of home building in the United States and around the world, but especially in the United States as we look at those numbers. So what impact does that have on our overall economy as we try to get back to whatever normal will be?
Oh, it's definitely a drag on the economy. You start to think about trying to put people back to work. If you don't have the base materials, then you're not going to be able to build that house, which means that you're not hiring contractors or subcontractors. A couple of issues I'd like to throw on the table, though, Joe. This story really talks to a couple of other issues that I actually were concerned about when I was with the Department of Homeland Security. One is how fragile our elements of our trade system are. You know, what you're starting to see is the development of superports. The cargo container ships are growing in size, even though right now there's less to put on them, which means that there are fewer ports that can handle the level of trade that is required. Our trade routes are changing. If anybody's paying attention to what's happening up in the Arctic and you're starting to see the loss of the ice in the Arctic, that has opened up different trade routes. And we have the situation of a hot, cold standoff with Russia and even some of our typical European allies. It shows also the power and growth of both China and India and Vietnam at the expense of U.S. manufacturing. So there's an awful lot of issues that are wrapped up here. Now, you say, well, what do we do about it? I mean, I think there's several things that we can do about it. And, Alan, I think you're right. I think that times like this call out for the type of disruptive changes that we like to see in industry. And maybe there's the opportunity to marry the huge issue of plastics and unclaimed plastics to do more recyclable materials. I also think this is an opportunity for places like New York to really subsidize modern manufacturing and see how we can start to bring back manufacturing to places that it hasn't been in over a century, but with different technologies. Start to think about the 3D printing and additive manufacturing. There is an opportunity here, but But we have been, frankly, as a society, we've been very happy with cheap goods. You know, people like going to Walmart and, and buying that stuff, and all that stuff is coming from China and India, and we don't think about what it takes to make it, what it takes to ship it, and the impact. So this also ties in not only with the economics of the country, but also the environment.
The Harvard Business School source for this story said, the real question is, are we going to stop chasing low cost as the sole criteria for business judgment? I'm skeptical of that. Consumers won't pay for resilience when they are not in crisis.
Right. I won't. I'm one of them. I mean, your takeaway, Chris, was they're not lying. Mine is shop online and hoard, because this is going to continue. Normally, when we have stories like this, and your answer was brilliant, Bob, but it went in a different direction than I was expecting from you, because this was not a bad corporate policy. They discovered that not having inventory gave them, and it's in the story. You started to read that, Joe. There's flexibility. They could display more product. They could customize more. This was actually a really good business practice.
Right.
Where it fell off was an unusual, once-in-a-100-year event. It's similar, in my mind, to what happened in hospitals, where hospital costs were kept in containment by not having surplus supply. You only had as many of those big pieces of equipment, respirators and et cetera, as you really needed. And then when an emergency came, you're caught short. And that's the same thing that happened this time. So it seems to me that what's needed is not a change in the inventory policy, which has worked for 100 years, great, but for a change in how we handle emergencies, these once-in-100-year emergencies. And that's what I thought you were going to be addressing.
Well, I think you have to hit both sides. And in my mind, if you can't deal with the emergency unless you can deal with your day-to-day. And if you can't do, you know, your logistics on a day-to-day basis, you're sure as heck not going to be able to do it during a disaster. I think your example of the hospitals is spot on. I mean, that was meant to, what they were trying to do is to control
costs.
Right. So they saw the inventory and the space required for inventory that was taking bed space away from hospitals. It helped control the rising costs of health and health insurance. The unforeseen circumstances are exactly what you said, is that you can't then stock up when the disaster occurs, because we don't have the flexibility in the system that we used to. And that's why we started to see things like what we saw here in the Albany area, where we were printing personal protective equipment for the medical community using the little 3D printers in the Albany Library and the university. But it's that type of creativity, though, that I think could lead us to changes in how we think about our overall manufacturing footprint.
Right.
And that's where I think Alan is right, that there is an opportunity here as well.
Let us look. We have a couple letters on this, the shortage of goods. Do you think that Trump's trade policies have had any effects on these shortages?
Maybe, but honestly, I think I think COVID and the pandemic had a much, much larger impact. I also think that the changing climate is having a huge impact that we're not talking about. Mm-hmm. You think about the situation in Texas with a power outage. I mean, that took down some of the main plants that was doing plastic injection, which is one of the reasons that you can't find cars right now. Chips are the other one.
Yep.
The issue of chips is that we found it cheaper to have China and India build our chips for us rather than do it ourselves. So we really have lost a lot of capacity here in the country to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, but before we decide you can't get a car, let me tell you, I'm looking at cars, and I went into a Subaru place, and I went into a Prius place, and they both were more than willing to find me what I wanted right then and there. And, by the way, to Dicker.
Yeah, I think, but if you know, Alan, I think if you go on a lot of lots, even around here, you're going to see that the inventory is way
really
down. So I think that may be more. You found a sweet spot, and if you didn't buy, you may want to.
Yeah, I'm always looking for that.
Well, and also I found that when the cars, like if you look at the inventory, they'll tell you we have 27 cars, but those 27 cars are strewn across like four states. If you're the first person to say, "Oh, okay, I'll take this one," then, you know, somebody jumps in the drives it to wherever you are. But it's yeah, it's hard. And was really, and we got our car, I think, in July of last year, and it was like we had a choice of two, and that was it. It was like no colors, no. It was basically, do you want this one, which is this price, or this one that's that price? I'm like, oh. I think I'll take that one. That seems more reasonable.
Yeah, and for people who are listening, remember though that there's a whole line of jobs that are that we don't have. We're not filling it from Joe's story. You know, the sales department's not right. Hiring more salespeople.
Yeah.
The repair area probably is actually doing well because people are holding on to their cars longer, which means that mm-hmm. they're breaking down. But they're not going to a third shift in our manufacturing of vehicles, which really affects, if you start to think about what's happening in places like Georgia and Tennessee, because a lot of the plants have moved. So you start to see that the downstream potential impact of just the scarcity of vehicles, and then you multiply that by multiple other areas, and it does make me nervous about the overall strength of the recovery. I think what we have going for us right now is that people have so much pent up. They've been pent up for so long that they're ready to go out.
They've pent up everything.
Yes, pent up everything is exactly right, and they're ready to spend.
Yeah,
but there's also the crucial question of enough people to work.
Yeah.
All I can say is I invite anybody to Great Barrington, walk down our Railroad Street, which is our, you know, answer to Greenwich Village in New York, and you will see a help wanted sign on every single
true.
Business.
Yeah. Well, and businesses here that. I mean, how many, just a walk through Crossgates Mall, which is the largest mall north of New York City, I believe, or so they claim, that stores are closed, not permanently, but just have signs on them that said, we didn't have anybody to work today.
Now, Joe, this is an impact of Trump's policy, and it's the immigration policy mm-hmm. that's also at play here as well, because we have depended upon recent immigrants or people coming to this country to work
for foreign workers for long periods of time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So again, all of these policies are tied in. So let me correct something I said earlier. It's not all of Trump's policies, but I think the immigration policy really is impacting the workforce. We're also going to see this in the agricultural sector as well.
Right. We have this from Tricia. My electric oven range died on Easter during the baking of my scalloped potatoes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I finished them in the microwave, but they were very disappointing. We looked online and in appliance stores picked out a reasonably priced replacement, put a deposit on it, exclamation point in quotations, or in brackets rather, and are still waiting 2 months later. I brilliantly bought a single electric burner on Amazon and a good-sized toaster oven, so between those, the microwave and the gas grill in the backyard, we're managing. But it's really been eye-opening. And yeah.
Interesting.
By the way, if you want to, when everything's okay, we'll try those scalloped potatoes.
I think that's Ray's show on Friday, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Joe, you hit it. It's really interesting, though. You know, we're not making light of the situation, but we're so used to having certain things available to us. You know, a refrigerator breaks, and in the past where we may have said, oh, you know, we could get it repaired. It's so difficult to get modern appliances fixed. It's actually easier to junk them and get something new, which is, I think, also leading to the problem that if you can't get them, you're in trouble. And stoves are really important. And good luck with the scalloped potatoes. That does sound good, but I can't say that right now.
No.
Carbohydrate.
Right, yes. Exactly. Our dryer broke, and we said, oh, you know, when your dryer breaks, like, I'll get another dryer. So we called up our appliance guy, the local guy, because we like to buy local, and we said, oh, can we get a new dryer? And he said, well, I got about a 9-month wait on dryers. Gosh. And you're like, oh, well, I wonder how I dry my clothes. Hello, laundromat. So,
line in the backyard, clothespins. I'll show you one.
So then, no, I know. So then, about 3 weeks later, the guy calls up and he said, I can't believe this, but this, he said, I delivered this dryer to this woman and she said she hated the color. Which was white, by the way. she hated the color and said, I don't want it. So I thought that was an interesting sociological experiment of if you can't get a washer and then or a dryer and then you turn it one away, But we lucked out and we got it, and it's been delightful.
And you're okay with the color?
Yeah, the color of white is just fine. Yeah. We have a closet door we just shut, so it's all okay. M writes to us and says,
"You gotta admit though, your life is pretty good. With the biggest thing that you may be worried about is the color of your dryer.
Know,
so
these
props
are all
to whoever
first
that
world
person.
Well,
yeah.
I was horrified. I know I've told this story before. I was horrified one time when I was talking to a dog breeder, and I said, you know, how do you decide like who you're going to sell to? Because you have all these sheets and the things you fill out. And this is for rescue dogs as well. And she said, well, I made up a policy when a woman came in with fabric swatches from her sofa to match the coat of the dog.
Oh, my God. That was a no.
And she was like, yeah, that was where I decided to make some rules.
Oh,
I was like, wow. That's, yeah. M writes to us and says, the cost of a 2x4, 8 feet long, yes. In January, $4. May, $12.
Yeah.
So there's some real-life numbers for you. Okay. Let's move on to other stuff, and we have a break here in about 2 minutes, so I'll set up the story, and then we'll talk some more. I guess we can probably do this one in a few minutes, because I know we'll talk about it more on Friday with Judith. And that is the Arctic drilling. And I think this gets into one of those things that Rosemary was talking about before, that, you sign it in, and then whoever the next person comes in, they take it away. But Biden suspends drilling leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The decision blocks, for now, oil and gas drilling in one of the largest tracts of undeveloped wilderness in the United States. Good job, New York Times, for showing a really cute polar bear as the photo for this story of him sort of peeking his head out of a slushy, which I assume used to be like solid ice, and now isn't. This is off the Alaskan coast in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Biden administration suspended oil drilling leases, unspooling a signature achievement of the Trump presidency and delivering on a promise by President Biden to protect the fragile Alaskan tundra from fossil fuel extraction. Alan.
Well, I think it's how you sell what Biden is trying to do here. If it's just reversing, and I take some exception to the newspaper accounts, which all say, significant achievement of the Trump administration, whatever whatever words they're using. But I think, what Biden is obviously answering here is the idea of too much stuff in the atmosphere.
Right.
And if you sell it that way, I think it'll go. If you just sell it that, Trump did it and I'm reversing it, and the goo-goos, which is a term I've used for years, the goo-goos say, oh, that's great, but it isn't enough for all of the American people. It's enough for me, but not for all of the American people. And so so he's doing what he should do. But I think, as I said before, it's a question of how you sell that to the American people.
Who wants the 45 seconds we have left? Rosemary.
First of all, it's even more temporary than a executive order. What he did was agree to study them. So he hasn't even backed them off. He could put them back on the table again at any time. So it's very tenuous, way too early to celebrate. And he also has run into a political problem. He has totally pissed off the Alaskans, including Linda Murkowski.
Lisa Murkowski.
Lisa Murkowski, who is one of the few Republicans who has voted for Democratic stuff.
All right, we'll take a pause there. You got it in. Good for you. We're going to take a pause. We'll be back and continue with our conversation. Our last go around with our terrific panel. We welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this news break from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our final segment with our terrific panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your thoughts on all of these issues. So I wanted to get to the story yesterday, and we didn't, so let's get to it today. It's another one of these stories like in the sense of sort of larger range issues that are going on that maybe we don't always talk about. But with homicides rising, cities brace for a violent summer. Homicide rates in large cities were up more than 30% on average last year, and up another 24% for the beginning of this year, according to criminologists. The story struck me not only because of the numbers and the numbers nationwide, but also the numbers that we're seeing, Chris, right here in the city of Albany.
Yeah, there have been 9 homicides so far this year in Albany, which puts the city on pace to break its record pretty easily. And, you know, many of them are within walking distance of this studio.
They are.
Yeah. You bet.
And it's very scary. So the issue, the criminologist, you know, why, so they're bracing for a violent summer, but why is this happening? What sociologically?
Well, that's the $1 million question, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't think anybody really knows exactly. I mean, it probably has something to do with COVID. But
being pent up.
Yeah, and just, yeah. Although it's hard to draw, you know, say, oh, I feel pent up, so I'm going to go shoot somebody. I mean, to most of us, that doesn't seem to make logical sense. But, you know, COVID has
to
all
some of us, it does.
But that's, yeah, well.
Really?
Nobody on this panel, however.
Yeah. No.
But there are all sorts of economic ramifications from COVID. It's had a complex effect on society that I don't think we completely understand.
But when your numbers go up more than 30%, Bob, I assume that's more than a coincidence.
Back-to-back years, too.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of other factors here, too, Joe. I mean, as a country, we've refused to talk about any type of gun control. I mean, so gun control is something that Congress refuses to take up. And in fact, it's glorified. If you look at if you look what happens in sort of mass media, and I think Chris, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of pent up issues in our communities right now, including the sense that you know, everything is fleeting. You know, that rules don't apply. I mean, this goes back to a conversation we were having earlier about the insurrection on January 6th and the Trump supporters, that the rules don't apply, and it's okay to take what you want. It's okay to not say that you lost. I mean, all of these elements are leading to I think I agree with the article that I think it's going to be a really tough summer.
Yeah, it sure seems that way so far. You know, to speak to what you're saying about the glorification of violence, as someone with a young child, I try to protect her from commercials that are violent, you know, and it's almost impossible. You'll be watching a kid's show or, you know, a sporting event on a Sunday afternoon and the commercials come on and it's people shooting each other. And it's just like, come on, do we realize that kids are watching this stuff? I mean, we are a violent culture. We have long been a culture that glorifies violence, and we're a country that's awash in guns. And all of that certainly plays a big role in what's happening.
Isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting that we have rules on television that you can't show commercials of people smoking or people drinking, but you can of people shooting each other?
Yeah,
and that's very odd.
I also think there's a political price to be paid here. I mean, in Albany, for example, we have a mayor who is going to be held responsible for the amount of violence in our neighborhoods. Because if there's one thing that people care about more than anything else, it's the safety of them and their families and their children and all the rest. So, I think our mayor has been very, very, in Albany, has been very dedicated to making things right. And to equalizing everything. But in the end, she's got a police department, and they have to do what is necessary to protect people. Chris, I don't know what you're finding there in terms of your checking around with people as to the mayor's political future.
I think if she had a strong – I mean, she's up for election this year. If she had a strong opponent, I think this could be an issue that somebody could make hay with. The thing that's tough, though, is when you're talking about a national phenomenon,
right.
It's very hard to say how you can hold a local mayor. I mean, she's not responsible for, you know, the flood of guns into the city or so many things. I mean, the other part of this that we haven't talked about is police. And, you know, this is where it gets really controversial. But some people would say that police, because of the protests following the death of George Floyd, police have really backed off on their policing. I tend to doubt that's responsible for this. So other people would say that, you know, communities trust the police less now, and they're less likely to cooperate with police or less likely to call 911 when there's a situation that people are taking justice into their own hands more, and then that's partly responsible for this. I don't think anybody really has the answers, but it is certainly a confounding thing. And I think it's something that politicians on the national level, Joe Biden in particular, need to address and need to address quickly, because I do think, as Alan alluded to, there are political ramifications for this. There, nothing will cause a political backlash faster than rising crime rates. You know, there was an article in the New York Times a couple of days ago about, you know, the city of Atlanta and the Buckhead neighborhood trying to secede from the city of Atlanta because of rising crime. You know, this is a significant thing that I think needs to be on the radar of every elected official.
Rosemary?
Well, it is, to me, looking for the solutions seems really, it's just so inadequate, and that includes the media and the politicians. You know, the story today is, does the mayor in Albany have confidence in the police chief? How did this all get on the police chief's back? Some of it, as you say, definitely is our attitudes towards and by police that have added to this, but it isn't just one person, as if replacing him, as if finding the ideal police chief is going to solve the whole problem.
Right.
Or even replacing the mayor, strong candidates against her or not, is replacing Sheehan really going to change anything? It's so much deeper than that. And the media's, aside from this program and you all talking, I've not heard a really decent conversation about what's needed. When I have heard it, it's been about gun control. And as you've said, not a single thing has been done about that.
The context is really important. I think I get a lot of letters from people furious about what's happening in Albany. And I always remind them that this is a national, this is a national phenomenon. It's not unique to Albany.
Right.
And the
and
other
yet
context,
they write
too,
two letters about Albany, Chris. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
They want.
Well, that's because he's connected.
Right.
Chris knows Albany. He can do something.
But the other context is that homicide rates are down dramatically from what they were in the 1980s and 1990s, and people tend to forget that, too. They seem to think that this is something new. But, I mean, homicide rates, as scary as the increase is, they're still way below what they used to be.
But one thing it's not is defund the police. I was reading an article. See, this is what happens when you defund police. We haven't defunded police. Very few communities have even considered that legislation. So that's it. Everybody's using the situation to get their own political agenda across.
Police departments haven't been defunded. But it does, I think, make the defund the police slogan ring
stupid name for it. Yeah.
It makes it for people who are dealing with crime increases, I think that it does seem out of touch.
Right.
But again, I think it drives home the fact that we have to rethink what policing is and how do we get trusted individuals into communities where they're not only trusted, but they are part of the community. And this is where you start to think about, you know, your mental health experts and your social welfare and how do you, you know, how can you go into the neighborhoods and start to calm down some of the emotions that are leading to some of these behaviors, which I really think is part of what we need to do when we start to talk about rethinking what modern policing is.
Mm-hmm. And the Albany police chief and Mayor Sheehan would tell you that COVID prevented them from doing a lot of the calming down efforts that they had in place because, you know, social distancing. And that might explain last year's increase. But how does it explain this year's? But there's also a contagion effect that happens where the more violence there is, the more people turn to violence as kind of the solution.
Yes.
You know.
That's right.
Going back to what you said about guns, you know, USA Today did an interesting investigative piece and found that gun dealers who are found to be violating the law are not treated harshly. The ATF, the penalties are slaps on the wrist. You know, that's another thing. If you want to stop the flow of illegal guns, you've got to crack down on gun dealers who are making the guns available, you know, but too often that isn't happening.
So that goes back to the police.
Well, it also goes back to the federal policy that would, you know, I think you know, the Biden administration should reform ATF and crack when there are laws on the books that are being violated and people aren't being punished, punish those people. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's the simplest thing in the world.
Diane writes to us and says, we can't even study gun violence in this country. Let's start there, please.
It's true. Under the former administration, all of the smart gun technology that was being investigated by both Homeland Security and the Department of Justice through its National Institute of Justice was all stopped. And this is also part of the seeds of what the NRA has planted about not even considering the idea of technologies that could be used to allow for legal but safer gun ownership. Mm-hmm. So any talk about limiting firearms is now viewed as verboten by folks down in Washington, which means that we're not going to have a comprehensive federal policy. And frankly, it doesn't do us any good if New York has really strict policies, but Virginia makes it, you know, mm-hmm. heck, you think about Texas. It's easy to bring a gun to church and there's a ballot. I mean, how crazy is that? You know, going back to the conversation we had earlier.
Mm-hmm. And Alan, I mean, also you have a lot of fear of people just because of the numbers and a concern about what it's like to walk down the streets of these cities.
Yeah, and we also have to remember what this is all about. You know, there was a lot of talk about defund the police, and I think we've all agreed that that's sort of nonsense. Nevertheless, the composition of the police, the way we recruit people for the police, that is huge. I must say, we have a new police chief in our little town of Great Barrington, and he's doing a superb job. You never heard that really said about his predecessor. So, and maybe you heard it, but I never heard it. So who these people are, whether or not they've been given some kind of a test as to whether or not they're satisfactory. We had an incident in our area where the team that had to come in was led by a social worker because things were changing, and they should.
I just one small correction. I agree with much of what you say, but it's not true that everyone on the panel thinks that defunding the police is a nutty idea. I think it has a lot of merit, badly named and labeled, but to put more money into police now, which is what they're calling for, I think is ridiculous. That we need to look at how we police and what we might fund instead: better and more mental health treatment, use of social workers, and non-gun carrying. Yeah, all the things you said, I agree, but I do think that defund the police is viable and really overdue.
I don't. I disagree with you on that. I think defunding the police. I mean, I think if we want the police departments that we should all want, it's going to take more money, not less money. I think they need better training. I think you need more police. I think you need police who are out walking, doing the kind of community policing that we'd like to see. And I don't think it has to be an either or. I think you fund the police and you also fund all the programs that people are talking about shifting money to. You know, there's a big pot of money coming to a lot of municipalities from the federal government right now. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a good opportunity to both, you know, evolve the police into the police departments that you want to have and also fund a lot of the programs that people want to see the money shifted toward. The money is available, and we have a crisis, so this is the time to do it.
We have a crisis. We're out of time.
Darn.
Okay.
Oh, no.
And he gets the last word? Oh, my gosh. All right. I'm walking out with you to the parking lot.
Somebody's only on one day a week. Okay. So we'll end there.
You can refute everything I said tomorrow.
My executive order.
Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Chris, Bob, Rosemary, wonderful to have you here in the studio. Thank you so much. We'll be back right after this.